1260 AM Amory. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Michelle Franzen. GOP presidential hopeful Nikki Haley canvassing the Granite State ahead of Tuesday's open primary, where independents could reshape the race following Donald Trump's win in Iowa. Haley ratcheting up her criticism of her former boss, ABC's deputy political director, Avery Harper, has more.
Nikki Haley has really been being clearer in her criticisms of former President Trump as she has pushed back on his assertions that he has presidential immunity amid these legal cases that he's facing. She's also been more apt to liken him to President Biden in terms of lots of things. And so we've seen her say that, do we really want to see 80-year-olds running for president?
Trump will hold an event tonight in Manchester. Ron DeSantis is in South Carolina today. In Israel, demonstrations taking place outside the prime minister's house, families of hostages held by Hamas in Gaza expressing frustration over Israel's government and getting the more than 100 captives released, and the big chill continuing its grip on much of the nation this weekend. This is ABC News. More troubles for Boeing following Thursday's emergency landing in Miami for a Boeing cargo plane due to an engine fire. An inspection finding a hole over the number 2 engine. More from ABC's Jacqueline Lee.
Boeing saying in a statement, "We are supporting our customer and will support the NTSB investigation into this incident. We also recommend you contact the engine maker GE Aviation."
New images in an alleged murder-for-hire plot a decade ago involving a Florida law professor. ABC's Rena Roy has more.
New body camera video shows Florida police arresting Grandma Donald Adelson at Miami International Airport as she and her husband attempt to board a one-way flight to Vietnam. The 73-year-old facing first-degree murder and solicitation of murder charges, accused of conspiring with her son and several others to have her former son-in-law, FSU law professor Daniel Markell, killed in the driveway of his home in 2014.
Adelson due back in court Monday. Michelle Franz on ABC News.
Hey everybody, how we doing? I'm Charlie Behrens inviting you to join me Saturdays and or Sundays at noon. It's a horse apiece, whatever you decide. We're doing the Cripes Cast, where we talk to people for and or from the Midwest, and it's more fun than a six-pack of Jolly Good. Okay, the pride of Random Lake, that Jolly Good is. Anyway, it's on your Civic Media station and the Civic Media app. And do me a favor, yeah, tell your folks I says hi. Okay, real good. Folks, I tell you this much, the Cripes Cast is just the butter on my cheese.
When it came time, like, oh, I'm going to pursue comedy. At the time, it was like, well, it was New York and Los Angeles. I'm like, I knew more people in New York. I knew you'd get funnier in New York and there's more stage time. I'm like, I'm going to L.A. If my dreams are going to come crashing down, I'd rather have them come crashing down on the beach.
Cripes Cast every Saturday and Sunday at noon across Civic Media and on the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Winter is an especially dangerous time for people with Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia. Mark Moran explains.
People who suffer from dementia face a host of increased risks in winter months. Everything from falls to getting lost, even in places that used to be familiar. And in the winter, the Alzheimer's Association's Lauren Livingston says low temperatures, ice, and darkness are just a few things that make conditions especially dangerous for people with dementia, but there are others.
One big one is wandering. That can be a problem for people living with Alzheimer's or dementia, especially in severe weather. They don't really understand, maybe when they go outside, that it's dangerous, so they might not put on any coats or additional clothing to keep warm. And if they wander, they may get lost and not be able to find their way home.
Livingston says keeping track of people with dementia in the winter is especially critical. Memory problems are hallmark signs of people living with dementia, but Livingston says there's another equally debilitating symptom called sundowning, which is made worse in shorter, darker days.
It can cause them to become a little bit more agitated in the evening time when the sun is going down, and with the sunlight being less and less in the winter time, it can cause for a longer period of time for people with dementia to experience the sundowning and be more agitated.
She adds that people with dementia are also more prone to falls, a risk made worse by snowy, icy weather. There are currently more than 6 million people nationwide living with Alzheimer's disease. There's no cure and very few treatments available proven to slow its progress. This is Mark Moran. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, sunshine, high temperatures around 10 degrees. For tonight, partly cloudy, single digits below zero. Partly sunny, breezy for Sunday. We'll see winds gust to 30 miles per hour, highs in the upper teens. For Monday, mostly cloudy, highs near 30 degrees.
Right now, 6 degrees.
Connecting with you on air, online, and on the Civic Media app. This is Lake Air 1260 AM, WLAK, Amory's radio station.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Hey, what's up now?
Brother, what's up? This
is a pre-recorded, man.
Yeah, brother, like it. Solid. Right on.
Brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find.
Good morning and welcome to a very, very special edition of the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. Good morning to you, Calvin. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good, Earl. I think we're going to start trending towards the warmer direction starting today.
Yeah, we're going from, what, 20 below to 7 or 8 below. I I don't know if we can really tell the difference, but I guess every degree makes a difference. But I want to say to the listening audience that we're about to go on what I think is as important a conversation that I've ever been a part of. And I want you all to listen intently to what you're about to hear. We constantly on this program talk about our government. We talk about the fact that, you know, it's a representative government, and so we vote and we do all those things, and we expect our government to do so many things for us because we aren't certainly capable of dealing with all the different things that go on in a society. And so it is important, critically important, that we have conversations like the one that we are about to have. And this is all about a conversation and it's called gain of function. And I don't know how many of you in the listening audience are aware of what gain of function means, but we're about to find that out along with many other important discussions that are included in gain of function. And I want to begin by introducing three scientists and professors. And, you know, these bios will, if nothing else, I hope they don't scare you away. But these are very, very accomplished men who are going to take the time out to explain to us in a language that hopefully we can understand about the importance of gain of function and some really important things that are happening not only in the state of Wisconsin, but across the nation. I want to begin by introducing Richard H. Ebright. He is a Board of Governors Professor of Chemistry and Chemical Biology at Rutgers University and Laboratory Director at Waxman Institute of Microbiology. He received his PhD in microbiology from Harvard University and was Junior Fellow of the Harvard University Society of Fellows. In 1987, he was appointed as a Laboratory Director at the Waxman Institute and faculty member at Rutgers University from 1997 to 2013. He was co-appointed as investigator of the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. He has received the Surly Scholar Award, the Schering Plug Award of the American Society for Biochemistry and Molecular Biology, and the National Institutes of Health Merit Award. If that doesn't scare you away, he is also a fellow of the American Academy of Microbiology, the Infectious Diseases Society of America, the American Association for Advancement of Science, and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He is a member of the Institute International Biosafety Committee of Rutgers and has been a member of the Antimicrobial Resistance Committee of the Infectious Diseases Society of America, the Working Group of Pathogen Security of the State of New Jersey, and the Controlling Dangerous Pathogens Project of the Center for International Security Studies. He has testified to U.S. House and the U.S. Senate on biosafety, biosecurity, and biorisk management. Whew. And that's just part of what he's accomplished. Let's go now to Simon Wayne Hobson. He is an Emeritus Professor of Virology at the Institute of Pasteur, Paris. Wayne Hobson obtained a PhD in biochemistry from the University of Oxford in 1977, served as a postdoctoral fellow at the Weizmann Institute of Science from 1977 to 1980, and thereafter moved to the Pasteur Institute in Paris. He and his colleagues were the first to sequence the genome of the virus that causes AIDS. Man. Wow. Wayne Hobson is the co-founder of two biotech companies working to develop countermeasures against cancer. Wayne Hobson won the Andre Wolf Prize in 1996 and Athena Prize from the French Academy of Sciences in 2007, and as Officer de la Lyon of UNAR, Wayne Hobson was appointed Officer of the Order of the British Empire in 2022 from his services in the field of virology. Bryce Nichols is Professor of Genetics at Rutgers University and Laboratory Director at the Waxman Institute of Microbiology. He received a PhD in microbiology from Harvard University in 2002 and served as a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard Medical School from 2002 to 2007. In 2007, he was appointed as laboratory director at the Waxman Institute and faculty member at Rutgers University. He has received the Pew Scholar Award and is a fellow of the American Academy of Microbiology. In 2023, he and Richard E. Bright were two co-founders of Biosafety Now, a nonpartisan New Jersey-based 501c3 nonprofit organization whose primary mission is to protect public safety by reducing the likelihood of laboratory-generated pandemics. Good morning to you all, and thank you very much for taking time out of your busy mornings to share with our audience.
Thanks, Earl. Thanks a lot for having us on. And I guess I will say that we really appreciate the opportunity to be able to speak to the public. And I know, I would say that one of the things is, you know, reading those bios and stuff, like it, I kind of want to point out that we're here in a sense because we're all members of the public. I think that these accolades and you know, having the degrees, they don't make us, you know, the key thing here is that we're coming here because we need the public's help, because we're concerned as scientists that we're, the scientific community is using those credentials to sort of, you know, tell the public that everything's okay and we don't need to be, you know, regulated, we don't need certain things to be prohibited that we're doing. But the reality is that that that's just not true. So that's really what we're here for. As you said, I'm one of the co-founders of Biosafety Now, along with Richard Ebright and Justin Kinney, who's not on here today, but myself and Justin actually traveled to Wisconsin this past Wednesday in order to testify on behalf to support a new bill that Richard's gonna go into more detail on, that would prohibit the topic that we're talking today, which is gain of function research, but also would introduce much needed public transparency, which is something that's not being discussed a lot about that bill, which is the fact that a lot of the activities that scientists are doing are done in secret, without the public's knowledge, and importantly, without the public's consent. And that's really why I think this particular bill is one that everyone should rally around as sort of an apolitical bill. It should receive bipartisan support. And that's really what our goal is, to sort of make it clear that this is about public safety. It's about public welfare. It's about putting common sense protections on the public. Calvin, you have a question?
Well, no. So guys, before we get into all of that, I have to ask you a question from the perspective of the community. We have just come out of a terrifying COVID-19 couple years ago that terrified America to its soul. And we were hearing different things from different people, not knowing whom to trust, where it came from, what the solutions were, whether we should take vaccinations or not. We're still there. And so if you guys can explain to us, as we saw so many loved ones die and did not get, I guess, a real understanding about where COVID-19 came from and what pathogens are and all of those different things, if you guys could take walk us down that path before we get into the rest of it.
Richard, you want to take that one, or Simon?
Richard, please.
Something to focus on would be where it came from.
Yes, sir. Which
is one of the questions you raised. So all available evidence indicates that SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, entered humans through one of two possible routes. The one route is natural spillover, in which a virus circulating in wildlife, in animals, makes the jump to humans and infects humans and spreads from there. The second possibility is a laboratory incident. A virus being studied in a laboratory jumps to humans, most typically by infecting a laboratory worker, a researcher, or even a maintenance worker or janitorial staff, and then is transmitted to the community and spreads from there. Two possible origins.
So, Professor, if you guys can hang on a second, we've got to take a short hiatus. When we come back, I want to pick up Richard from that point. I think it's clearly important. I am so honored to have on this morning Professor Richard E. Bright, Professor Bryce Nichols, and Professor Simon Wayne Hobson, all the way from Paris, France, who is joining us this morning, 844-967-2789. We're discussing gain of function on the Earl Ingram Show. To bring some love and get here today. Picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality.
You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK.
To the big-hearted, the bold, the teachers, the growers, the builders, the change makers. We need you. We are the Peace Corps. In more than 60 countries, we go the distance to make a difference. We're volunteers, partners, communities, bringing our experience, joy, and passion to building a better world together. Are you looking for more? Then we are looking for you. Join us at peacecorps.gov.
Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
Stop.
That dog does not want to be petted.
A heads up before something bad happens.
You should not send that text.
Uh-oh. Life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. With early diagnosis and a few healthy changes, you can reverse prediabetes and prevent or delay type 2 diabetes. To learn your risk, take the 1-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
Lake Air, 1260 AM WLAK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to a very special edition of the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. I am so excited and to introduce to you my guests this morning, Professor Bryce Nichols, Professor Simon Wayne Hobson, and Professor Richard H. E. Bright, as we talk about gain of function. Professor E. Bright, before we went to break, I was talking about the COVID virus, but I guess maybe where I should have begun was, what is a pathogen?
That's a good question. A pathogen is an agent that causes an infectious disease. Examples would be viruses, bacteria, microbiological parasites. So a pathogen is what you would call a germ.
And so as COVID was coming into existence and the American people were terrified, and there were some who said it was certainly something that occurred from an animal, you said the other option was that it happened in a scientific arena. Nobody knows to this day.
There clearly are two possibilities, which I described before. Natural spillover came from an animal. Laboratory spillover, it came from a laboratory. We do not know definitively the answer, but a preponderance of evidence now indicates that it came to humans through laboratory spillover. And if you would, I could summarize what those lines of evidence are. Make 10 points. The first point is that the pandemic is caused by a bat SARS-like coronavirus and emerged in the city of Wuhan, which is a city that's 800 miles from the nearest wild bats with SARS-CoV-2-like coronaviruses, but that contains the labs that were conducting the world's largest research program on precisely that category of viruses. If one considers the timeline in 2015 to 2017, so that's 4 years before the pandemic to 2 years before the pandemic, scientists and science policy specialists expressed concern that the Wuhan Institute of Virology, a laboratory in Wuhan, was conducting and contemplating research that posed an unacceptable risk of a lab accident that would trigger a pandemic. So there were concerns about the specific research project in that specific location already in 2015 to 2017. Then in 2017 to 2018, the Wuhan Institute of Virology constructed a novel hybrid SARS-like coronavirus. That is a virus that combined parts of one bat SARS-like coronavirus with parts of another bat SARS-like coronavirus, and the resulting artificial engineered hybrid coronavirus was able to infect and replicate in human airway cells, human lung and tracheal cells. And when it did so, it had 10,000 times enhanced viral growth and 4 times enhanced lethality in mice that were engineered to display human SARS receptors on their cells. Then in 2018, just 1 year before the outbreak arises, in a National Institutes of Health, NIH grant proposal, the Wuhan Institute of Virology and its collaborators proposed to construct more such hybrid SARS-like coronaviruses, specifically aiming for chimeras that would replace the natural spike gene, the gene that controls the specificity of the virus for what species it targets with novel spike genes that had higher binding affinities to human cells. And also in 2018, again, just 1 year before the outbreak, in a Department of Defense grant proposal, Wuhan Institute of Virology and its collaborators proposed to insert a special sequence that enhances, or is expected to enhance, the ability of the virus to infect and propagate, a sequence called a furin cleavage site. And they proposed to insert that at a specific location in the genome, in the nucleic acids, the genetic information for bat SARS-like coronaviruses. Then throughout that period, in 2017 to 2019, they did this research using a biosafety standard called Biosafety Level 2. This is a biosafety standard that every dentist's office in the United States meets. This is not what you see in pictures of people working in spacesuits. This is like a dental office. And it's a biosafety level that's patently inadequate, utterly inadequate for work with an enhanced potential pandemic pathogen, such as they were constructing. And then we know in 2019, a novel SARS-like coronavirus that had a spike with high binding affinity for human cells and that had a furin cleavage site at precisely the location proposed in their Department of Defense proposal emerges on their doorstep. And that virus is the only one of more than 870 known SARS-like coronaviruses that contains that key feature called the furin cleavage site. It also has genetic features that are unusual for bat SARS-related coronaviruses. These are features that don't rule out a natural origin, but are explained much, much more easily by a lab origin, specifically a lab origin that involves the category of research known as gain-of-function research, which is research in which scientists, by intent, introduce features into the virus or into a bacterium, so into a pathogen, introduce features that are reasonably expected to increase the ability to transmit or reasonably expected to increase the ability to do damage and kill.
So you you mentioned the Department of Defense, and Wuhan is in China. United States Department of Defense engaged, involved with this. The purpose of it, what is the purpose of creating such a virus?
Yes, it was two parts to that. First, the National Institutes of Health is the United States government funding agency. The Department of Defense that I'm referring to is the United States Department of Defense. The United States federal government was directly involved in this research project, instrumentally funding this project through the United States Agency for International Development, through the National Institutes of Health, and the researchers requested additional funds from the United States Department of Defense. So the second part of your question is why? This is research that is not pursued to develop new vaccines or new drugs. This research has no civilian applications. It has no medical value. It has no industrial value. It has no commercial value. So the research is not being performed to improve your health or my health or your listeners' health. The research is being performed for other reasons.
844-967-2789. We've got to go to a short hiatus, a very, very special edition of the Earl Ingram Show. I'm joined by Professors Bryce Nichols, Professor Simon Wayne Hobson, and Professor Richard E. Ebright as we have a discussion about a bill that is in docket in UW-Madison, Assembly Bill AB 413. And gain of function is what this is about, and so we're gonna delve into it. So don't touch that dial. 844-967-2789. We'll return.
From the Mississippi to the Apple and points eastward, you're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK, Amory's radio station.
ABC News, I'm Michelle Franzen. GOP presidential hopeful Nikki Haley canvassing the Granite State ahead of Tuesday's open primary, where independents could reshape the race following Donald Trump's win in Iowa. Haley ratcheting up her criticism of her former boss, ABC's deputy political director, Avery Harper, has more.
Nikki Haley has really been being clearer in her criticisms of former President Trump as she has pushed back on his assertions that he has presidential immunity amid these legal cases that he's facing. She's also been more apt to liken him to President Biden in terms of lots of things. And so we've seen her say that, do we really want to see 80-year-olds running for president?
Trump will hold an event tonight in Manchester. Ron DeSantis is in South Carolina today.